Thank you very much. I would like to give you an overview of our activities in using machine learning for many-body physics problems. And I'm generally excited about using computer science or developing computer science methods for natural science problems. And in about 1999, I was working in one of these dot-com startups, which was focusing on artificial intelligence. And back then, we mostly did things like multi-agent systems and also some neural networks. But at that time, it was very difficult to get excited about neural networks because you really couldn't do too much with them. And you could pretty much do anything that you could do with neural networks back then better with a linear method or a classical statistics method in the right nonlinear feature space, right? But in about 5 years ago, my view of this dramatically changed, because when automatic differentiation tools became available and GPUs became fast enough that you could do things with that. So then it became very interesting to do deep learning in order to make progress in the natural sciences. So this is essentially what my group is doing. And focus of that is basically, how can we build physics driven or physics constrained learning method that help us in making advances of in fundamental physics problems. And when I say physics-based or physics-constrained, what I mean is, in physics, we often have, or we usually have, certain theories or equations, and we know a lot about the structure of the problem. We know constraints or symmetries or something like this. And we are very interested in getting solutions to these problems that respect these symmetries and constraints, etc. And sometimes the physics itself tells us actually what the learning problem is. So this is what we are trying to do, develop machine learning methods that respect the right physics for the problem. And I'll talk about two applications of deep learning to physics. First, in statistical mechanics, where we focus on the sampling problem, the multi-body sampling problem. And the multi-body sampling problem basically consists of generating samples from a probability distribution that is defined by this multi-body energy function. And that could be an energy function that describes the interactions of atoms in a protein. And here you see the different states that a protein samples at room temperature. So you can see it's many-body system, and it's very complex, and it samples very different states. It's very difficult to predict which states would be accessible with which probability by just looking at the structure. So it's a difficult problem. And we need to solve this problem in order to compute properties of such systems. So be it molecules or materials, properties such as, what is the solubility of this in water? What is the probability of this protein to bind a certain other molecule, like a drug molecule, etc.? These are average properties, so they are expectations of something with respect to this probability density. So we need to sample efficiently. The other problem I'll talk about in the second part of the talk is application to quantum mechanics, where we want to solve the electronic structure problem. So basically, we want to compute this energy function, so the energy eigenvalue, for a given molecule. And for this, we need to solve this eigenvalue problem subject to some constraints. And that is a difficult problem, of course, especially if we want to do it with a high accuracy. The higher the accuracy, the higher the worse the scaling of the methods that are used here. So first part will be mostly about addressing this sampling problem, which is a very expensive problem, more efficiently with machine learning. The second problem is getting accurate solutions to the electronic structure problem at an acceptable computational cost with the help of machine learning. And to say a little bit more about the sampling problem, consider this example here. This is what biologists would consider a toy problem. So these are two small proteins. One protein is an inhibitor to the other, so it basically deactivates the other protein when they bind. And these two proteins are in a solvent box. This is about 100,000 particles. And if we do use a classical model for the interaction energy of the atoms, which is something we can fairly quickly evaluate in a few milliseconds for this 100,000 particle system. And we simulate the classical mechanics, so the dynamics, the classical Newtonian dynamics of the system on a GPU, then we can simulate something like a microsecond in a few days on one GPU. That's a microsecond of real time, but it takes us a few days to do that. If we did that for 1 or 2 months, we could maybe see these two proteins binding to each other. And then they're very sticky, they like to stay bound, and in real time it takes about a few hours for them to dissociate again. So simulating that would take us a century. So this is clearly unsustainable. Now there are a lot of tricks to make this problem feasible. So we can use machine learning in order to learn the manifold of relevant dimensions on which the long timescale motions or the rare events take place. So we can reduce these 300,000 dimensions to maybe 10. That is enough to describe the long time events. And then we can discretize the space into discrete states. And if we have learned the right dimensions, we can actually describe the dynamics with a memoryless Markov chain. So it's now a discrete jump process between these different states, bound and unbound and other intermediate states. And if we combine that with active learning or reinforcement learning, in order to plan at any given time for any given model of our current data, what is the best way to start new simulations to explore new states or to enhance the sampling of transitions where we have little data, then we can iteratively construct this model, which describes the binding and the dissociation, even though that's a process that takes actually hours, and we couldn't simulate that just by direct numerical simulation. But in this way, we can simulate it if you collect 2 milliseconds of total data. But it's still incredibly expensive to do that. So first of all, it takes a lot of human time to do that. It may get somebody a PhD, which is a nice thing. But perhaps the most shocking way to illustrate the expense of this is the sheer amount of energy that you spend on doing this and getting a one non-transferable model of this particular set of two proteins binding to each other is 500 gigajoule. That's what we pay for about 20,000 GPU days, 500 gigajoule. What does that mean? Well, the energy to launch a Saturn V rocket and a 50-ton payload into lunar orbit is about 1,500 gigajoule. So basically, we're burning a lot of rockets here to get a non-transferable model of something that biologists consider a toy problem. So I would like to propose a different approach of doing sampling. And this leads me to this topic of Boltzmann generators. So who of you is familiar with generative machine learning or generative models? Okay, good number. And who has heard of generative adversarial models or variational autoencoders? Okay, great. So I will not talk about these two models, but about a related model. So the idea of generative machine learning is the following. We have an object, a set of objects, like in this example, it's just faces. images or faces, and we want to generate samples of them. And in generative machine learning, typically the function from which we want to sample, so the probability density, is implicitly defined. It's just defined by examples, like a database of images. So we want to train a machine to learn this distribution and sample from it somehow. We couldn't write down what this distribution is in the case of images. What is the probability distribution of images? It's unclear. We have an implicit idea of what looks like a face and what doesn't. The idea of directed generative models is we want to train a function which takes as an input samples from a probability density that are easy to generate, like, for example, multi-dimensional Gaussian normal distribution, and just transform that to samples of our object of interest, to something that looks like a face, for example. And of course, this function in this particular example needs to be very complicated. So we may want to use something like a deep neural network. And then the question is, how do we train this deep neural network to do this job? Okay, there are several examples of this type of learning model, such as generative adversarial networks. This is a class of likelihood-free methods or intractable likelihood methods. So in other words, we can train the network somehow to give us examples of things that look like faces, but we do not know what is the probability with which we generate a given sample. Then variational autoencoders is something called an approximate likelihood method. So what we actually optimize is a bound to the likelihood. But we still cannot compute the exact likelihood of a given sample. And I will be interested in exact likelihood methods. So those are methods where every time we draw a sample, we know the probability density of doing that. And one example of such a method is GLOW. So GLOW is an exact likelihood method that has been developed for sampling faces. So these are actually samples of artificially generated celebrity faces. So these people don't actually exist. They are generated after having trained a network on an image database of celebrity faces, Celeb A. And these are one-shot samples. That means for every such face, we generate a field of pixels whose intensity is sampled from a normal distribution. And then there are several transformations, neural network transformations, that turn that into a face. And what you see here on the left are interpolations. So these are specific directions in this latent space, or in this space where we generate the noise variables. And they connect two points on the other side. So two faces on the side of the faces. But we connect them by a straight line in this noise space. And you can see that these interpolations do something interesting and relevant to these faces. So in this case, they interpolate between smile and non-smile, or beard and non-beard, etc. So this is the hope here. We want to do something like this for physics, so for a many-body physics problem, which is difficult to sample configurations of. We want to train a generative model that we can just feed with noise, and we get reasonable, that means low energy, samples from it. And we want to do things like interpolations in latent space and hopefully get paths that make sense. Okay, that leads me to this Boltzmann generator approach. So we have physics systems such as, let's say, an Ising model or a protein system or something where you have a theory that tells you this is a good energy function to model the system. Or maybe you compute it with some quantum mechanical method. But in any case, you have a multi-body energy function here. And this multi-body energy function defines the probability distribution up to a normalization factor that we usually cannot compute. And the exact way that the energy function goes into here depends on the thermodynamic state that you want to sample. So if you're interested in sampling the canonical ensemble, this would just be potential energy divided by thermal energy. And if you would like to sample in the isobaric ensemble, then there would be a pressure volume term here as well, etc. But in general, we can always say this is E to some minus reduced energy function. And this reduced energy function is something we know. So the objective is quite different from normal generative machine learning. We do not have, as a starting point, samples from the true distribution, and we want to infer the true distribution and then sample from it. But we want to avoid having samples from the full distribution, because then we would have self-solved the sampling problem already. But what we have is for every sample, we can evaluate the probability density exactly, up to the normalization constant. So what we want to use here is an exact likelihood method. We have the exact target density up to the normalization constant. So it's useful if we can use an exact likelihood method that can tell us what is the probability density with which it generates a sample. And a way to do this is the method of normalizing flows or flows. And the idea of that is here we have our samples, or here we have the space that we want to sample. So positions of atoms in three-dimensional space. And here we have the space in which we generate random variables. So that's the space that is easy to sample. In between, there is an invertible transformation, a trainable but invertible transformation. Also needs to be differentiable. So to be exact, this needs to be a diffeomorphism. Invertible differentiable map. And so the idea of this normalizing flow is that it takes this Gaussian density and then gradually, through several invertible layers, transforms it into the structure that we're interested in. So how do we build such a trainable invertible transformation? And how do we train it? First of all, the main idea of using this sort of approach, so an invertible transformation, is if we have a invertible transformations, we can use the transformation of random variables equation. So basically, if we know the probability density of Z, and if we can sample that, and we have this invertible transformation, then we can write down the probability density of X if we can just evaluate this function. That should not be too hard. And if we can compute the Jacobian of the transformation. That is not too hard if we design the network in the right way. And then the last step, and that is crucial here, We train this probability density to be similar to our Boltzmann distribution or whatever target distribution that we have. And then we reweight that. So in order to reweight, so to compute an importance weight of any given sample x, I need to know both these densities at a given point x. Then I can compute the ratio of them. And I can use this as an importance weight. Or I can use a Markov chain Monte Carlo method. And I use this as a px of x as a proposal distribution. And I accept with respect to this target distribution. And there are many other things I could do. Essentially, there are tons of statistical mechanics methods that do some form of reweighting. So this is what I need this probability density for. So for this reason, I need an exact probability method to generate samples X here. So a Boltzmann generator is an exact probability generative method plus a reweighting method. And the aim of a Boltzmann generator is to learn to generate unbiased samples from this target distribution. So that's how it's defined. And that has very many applications in physics, of course. This does not have to be literally a Boltzmann distribution. This could be an action of a path in a Feynman path integral method, or it could be an action of a lattice QCD method or something else. So whenever you have a distribution that you want to sample from, you can essentially use this trick. How do we implement invertible neural networks that are trainable? So there are essentially two classes of invertible neural networks that can be characterized as autoregressive methods and ResNets or continuous ResNets. In autoregressive methods, we somehow split the variables in such a way that we sample one group first and then another group conditioned on the other. And a simple way of doing this is to split our variables into two channels. One channel we just copy to the next layer. The other channel gets transformed as a function of the first channel. And this transformation has to be invertible. So in this case, the transformation is just a pointwise addition. So we can invert that with a subtraction. But this function t here does not need to be transformed. So we can evaluate this block that's called nice block in this direction, just forward. And we can evaluate it backward by simply inverting this arrow. This is the identity. And here we do x2 equals y2 minus t of y1. So t is not inverted. So that means t can be anything. It can be any feed-forward neural network with rectified linear units with whatever. As long as we can train it, that's fine. We don't need to invert it. Same, of course, can be done with multiplication and division. So now I have added a scaling layer to this translation layer. And what I've done now also is I've turned a volume-preserving transformation into a non-volume-preserving transformation. If I only do translations, this is volume-preserving. So the Jacobian of that transformation is actually 1. Now the Jacobian is not equal to 1, but it turns out it's easy to compute because it's just the product of the output activations of the scaling network. So it's just the product of all of the scaling factors. And so that's basically the idea here. We construct something that is invertible by design, and we construct it in such a way that we can compute the Jacobian. There are more advanced ideas than this, and this is a very active field. But so that's the gist of it. Now we can stack many of these blocks to a deep network. Of course, we should, if we do that, we should invert the roles of the two layers so that we transform both layers. Otherwise, we would just copy part of the variables deep. That wouldn't be very useful. And this way, we can get invertible, differentiable, trainable neural network. All right, so now how do we train this neural network to sample what we're interested in? One of the standard approaches to train generative neural networks is to use some form of probability distance. And the simplest one is the Kullback-Leibler divergence. So basically, that's a metric that tells us how similar are two distributions from one another. The KL divergence has several issues, but it is... It turns out it is the natural choice for this particular generative learning problem. If we do the following, if we say, what is the KL divergence between the probability distribution that we generate with the Boltzmann generator, with this directed generative model, and the Boltzmann distribution? So we just insert the probability to generate a sample and the Boltzmann density into the KL divergence, into the expression for the KL divergence, what we end up with is that it is equal to some constant factor, which contains the partition function, plus this expression. And this expression is saying compute the expectation value of samples generated from the Gaussian distribution, feed them through the network. So you generate a sample X and compute its energy. We know how to compute the energy of a given sample X. So this first term is simply minimizing the energy. That, of course, is not enough, because otherwise you would just collapse to the minimum energy point. So the second factor comes in through the Jacobian of the network. And it turns out that this is just an entropic factor. So we sample the Gaussian, and we minimize the mean energy, and we maximize the mean entropy. This is actually a free energy. It's a variational free energy. And the nice thing about this loss function is we don't need any examples, right? So we only sample Gaussian random variables, feed them through the network, and the only information we give to our network is what is our energy function that defines the probability density that we want to sample from. In practice, this alone is not enough, because in many of these problems you have multiple modes that are in different places in state space. And when the network has focused on sampling one node, then it will not know that there are other modes that it needs to find somehow. So in practice, what is important is to couple this with some sort of sampling algorithm that can discover new things, or to seed the training with some examples from different states. So maybe if you are interested in an Ising model, maybe you have an example of spins up and spins down each. So then we can train the network in the opposite direction. That is the typical direction how these generative neural networks are trained in machine learning. So it's data-based. So what we do here is actually we can generate this equation also by computing a KL divergence, the other KL divergence. But we cannot do that exactly, because that would require us to sample from the Boltzmann distribution, which we cannot in the beginning. So instead, we sample from data. And then it turns out to be a maximum likelihood instead of a KL divergence. So maximum likelihood instead of minimized KL divergence. But the equation we get has a very similar structure than here. We compute an expectation value over the data that we have. And we minimize an energy and we maximize an entropy. And the energy that we minimize is now the energy of a harmonic oscillator. And that's because we want to massage the networks so our training data becomes Gaussian in the latent space, and the energy that generates a Gaussian is a harmonic oscillator. So these are the two methods we use for training. And so here is an example. This is a two-well potential in two dimensions, very simple. We have some data on this side of the potential and some data on this side of the potential. Overcoming this barrier here, so transitioning between the two wells, is a rare event, so it takes long. And this yellow line just marks the transition region. It's not data we use for training, it's just to give you a visual orientation. So we train the Boltzmann generator with the red and the blue data. It learns to transform this 2D space into this space. So this is now the latent space distribution. And the gray disks just show you the 1, 2, and 3 sigma intervals of a Gaussian distribution. So this is the space we will sample from, transform back, and then sample from both of these wells. So what have we gained? We have gained a method to sample from these two wells IID, independent, identically distributed. And we know what's the probability with which we do that. So we can reweight, and we can now compute, for example, the probability of being on the left and on the right side of the well, or the free energy along this coordinate, so minus the log of the marginal distribution along of this coordinate. right? So this is the non-trivial thing that we can now do. And so here in black is the exact free energy along x1, and in orange and green are the result of Boltzmann generators with different parameters to estimate this free energy. So this shows you that you can get unbiased samples from your target distribution with this method. Now here, what you see is what we take a sample from the blue points and the red points, and we just do a linear interpolation between them in the latent space, in this space. And then we transform every point along that path back to real space. And this ends up to be pathways like this. So we get nonlinear pathways, of course, because this is a nonlinear transformation. And they more or less follow low energy pathways. So this indicates that the Boltzmann generator has learned some meaningful physics of the problem. Of course, here we have used data from both wells already. So we've used a lot of information. But we can also start with just one point. Write that into a data matrix. Now it's just copies of that one point. Maybe add a little bit of noise so that you don't get completely degenerated during training. Then train the Boltzmann generator that will then just sample around this point. And now do something to explore. And one thing you can do here, because you have now a latent space in which you hope the manifold of low energy structures is better represented than in real space. Now you can do sampling in latent space. So we can do Markov chain Monte Carlo in latent space. We have a point here. We just make a Gaussian displacement. We accept or reject with respect to the energy function in real space, because every point can be just mapped to the real space correspondent. And we can always have the Jacobians that we need for any such transformations. And then we update our data matrix, and we retrain, and we keep doing that. So we start here with one point. We first fill one energy basin, and eventually we find another energy basin, and then we fill that too. So in this way, you can explore. And you can turn essentially any sampling method, any statistical mechanics sampling method, now into a latent space sampling method. And while you're doing it, train the Boltzmann generator and improve your representation of the latent space. Yes?
Does this not depend on your fictitious temperature and the height of your free energy?
This depends on the temperature, yes. So you can, you have to define a temperature with to which respect you sample. For a given reference temperature that you choose, you learn a transformation to latent space. There is an interesting relationship between temperature and the latent space distribution for these transformations here. If I have these volume conserving transformations, then temperature turns out just to be the variance of the Gaussian in latent space. So I can actually learn multiple temperatures simultaneously with such a transformation, if I only train it with one. With this transformation, this is no longer exactly true, but I can still train it with a couple of temperatures and then sample from a whole family of temperatures. And that will be actually used in the next example.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Yeah,
exploration?
Absolutely.
So, when you train the neural network, when you train the latent representation of your data,
mm-hmm.
If you have only explored one basin, for example,
mm-hmm.
The latent representation or the function that maps a sample to its latent representation is only valid on this subspace of this on this submanifold, but it's not valid for parts where you have not explored your algorithm was not before exploring. So in all these parts where your algorithm has not learned how to transform a data point to your latent representation, I do not understand why a Monte Carlo exploration of the latent space would mm-hmm. still give you reasonable results.
Well, the function that learns the transformation has to have some sort of continuity for that to make sense, right? And so apparently that is the case. Now, how much more efficient will this be rather than exploring in real space in a high dimensional system? That is another question that we have to explore. But at this point, it's just, you know, there's a bijective transformation. This is just another representation of the data. The aim of this representation is, of course, to kind of cluster the high probability states. The question is, in this new metric, is exploring new points more efficient than the original space? Right? In the original space, you also don't know in advance where the other states will be. You just make random displacements and eventually find them. So this gives you some indication that this transformation can help even with the states that you haven't seen yet. But I agree with you, to make that argument solid, I think what we need is some sort of parameter sharing in our transformation. So if the parameters of our transformation represent more of the physics of the interactions, then I think it makes sense that learning from some example you can predict to other examples, right? If you have different degrees of freedom in your molecule or material that can flip, and you have seen some of them flip, then if your parameter structure allows you to represent it, it makes sense to say, okay, I've seen some of them flip, any combination of them is worth trying. And putting what I just said into neural network language means you have to share parameters. You have to have some sort of convolutions, for example, where you learn to represent certain parts of the problem with certain parameter sets that you reuse in other places, which we're not doing at the moment. So this is just an indication this works a lot better than straightforward sampling in low dimension, also with respect to the exploration. Yes?
If your degrees of freedom live on a specific manifold, so if you have like constraints,
yes,
can you embed them in this model, or the full model you have? Because like we also live in Euclidean space, right? And your degrees of physical degrees of freedom can be naturally like live on a circle or something like that.
So if it's hard constraints, that means it would reduce the dimension. So if I had, for example, fixed bond lengths or something, then it would effectively reduce the dimension. And then it's getting a little bit tricky because then I have somehow to build the constraint generator into this network. So currently we're not doing this. But it's a bijective map, so whenever I have hard constraints, then I have to reduce my dimension correspondingly and keep this dimension throughout the transformation. Okay, here's a more interesting example. So this is a box of repulsive particles. So they have 1 over distance to the 12th power repulsion. So these are pretty hard spheres, disks. And I have this pair of disks here, which has a double well potential, so it likes to be close together or somewhat further apart. And this transition is a rare event. And when I want to open or close the dimer, I have to move solvent particles around in order to do that because the system is very dense. And the Boltzmann generator can be trained on just samples from here and from here, and is actually able to generate low probability structures in one shot. Also intermediate states that haven't been used in the training. And so you see that the generated energy distribution in gray has a decent overlap with the equilibrium energy distribution from a molecular dynamics sample. So that means When there is some overlap, we're basically in the game for reweighting. So then we can use reweighting methods in order to compute the unbiased samples. And this goes back to your temperature question. So what we've done here is we just trained on a family of temperatures. And then predict the free energies of this distance coordinate for a whole range of temperatures, but with one Boltzmann generator. So all we do here is after the training, we just scale the variance of the Gaussian. Okay, this is an interpolation in latent space again. So this basically shows the opening of the Gaussian and the displacement of the solvent particles. And as a final example, I'd like to give this protein example. So now this is a very high dimensional example. It's still a toy problem for the biologists, but not for physicists. So this protein called BPTI, bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor. It has about 1,000 atoms. And this is how the atomic representation looks like. Some of you or many of you are not used to see proteins, but this is how it looks like. And basically a protein has a backbone, so that is a long polymer. And then there are things attached to it on the side, so side chains. So basically there's a long string, and then it's structured like a tree from there. We have to do a lot of tricks in order to get that to be sampled with the Boltzmann generator. And the main trick here is to develop a new invertible layer, which is essentially doing a coordinate transformation into a representation that makes this problem feasible. So we take the coordinates, we split them into two sets, backbone, the magenta one, and the side chains, so everything else. And the backbone coordinates are used in their Cartesian representation, but we do basically a principal component analysis. So we reorient that space, or we do a basis transformation, and we whiten the coordinates. So we scale all of them to variance one. And the other coordinates, the side chains, are represented in internal coordinates. So for every atom, we take the distance and two angles to three neighbor atoms. And we also normalize them to variance one. So in this way, we get a distribution here of this of these molecular structures, which already looks pretty Gaussian. So it has variance one in every single dimension. There are still some covariances, of course, that are not zero. And the mean is zero. So this is already pretty close to a Gaussian. And then we do the rest of the work with Gaussian. And then we can actually sample these structures. And this structure is actually such a sample. So this is really taking a sample from a 3,000 dimensional Gaussian, putting it through this transformation, and it generates a structure like this. And this is not an easy task, because if I displace one of these atoms a little bit here, the energy gives me a huge penalty. So it's very difficult to generate valid samples here. Indeed, the generated energy has a decent overlap with an equilibrium sample. And these are individual marginal distributions of bond lengths and angles. So this is a first step. I think, of course, exploring new states for systems like this is another issue. But we believe these Boltzmann generators can give you very useful representations to work with for sampling many body systems. And especially for systems where you have repetitive local structures, such as in Ising models or lattice QCD models, etc., these methods can be very useful, because then you can do things like convolution, and you can learn your local convolutional kernels and reuse them in many places. And then you can actually train something which has a much better chance of exploring new states that you haven't seen yet by sampling or resampling local local interactions. Okay, so the current work we're doing here is mostly building in more physics. So we want to have equivariant Boltzmann generators. So for example, energies have usually certain invariances. If you translate or rotate them, they are unchanged. And then the probability density defined by these energies also must be unchanged with respect to this translation and rotation. And so this needs to be built into the structure itself. All right. Questions on this part? Yes.
Have you tried that last model, but without this coordinate transformation?
Without a coordinate transformation, you get a hairball. Basically, this is really hopeless. So the coordinate transformation is essential in these molecules, in these bigger molecules.
And that intuition, like how did you identify the backbone and?
So the backbone. So this is a classical energy model. So it's a fixed topology. This connectivity graph here does not change. So that's fixed. That's known. And every protein is structured like this. It has this backbone, and then it has side chains. It's a polymer.
And they like are known to have like different timescales.
Roughly speaking, things in the backbone, so folding, unfolding, happens at longer time scales, but that's not a strict thing. The main idea here is that all of the side chains, because they basically have this tree graph structure, can be well represented with this internal coordinates, where you place one as a function of a few others. And the backbone basically defines the global structure. So the idea is just represent what you minimally have to represent in order to define the global structure with the in the Cartesian space, but then the normalization is very important, and then do everything else in internal coordinates, because that gives you things like rotation, translation, invariance for free. The normalization gives you something. It gives you for free that certain degrees of freedom are much stiffer than others. So for example, the vibrations around the bond length are very narrow. So placing it at the right bond length in Cartesian coordinates is very hard. But if you do it in internal coordinates and you scale the small distribution to variance one, then it's just as easy as doing anything else. So that's the basic idea. So this took a bit longer than I thought. I guess I have another 10 minutes or so. Would you like to hear about the electronic Schrödinger equation?
So I think we had a lot of questions, and we also started a bit later, so you can still go on for, say, 15 minutes.
15 minutes, that's fine. Okay, so now for something completely different. So the electronic Schrödinger equation is what we're now interested in. We would like to compute eigenstates of this equation. So we have a Hamiltonian defining a molecule or a material that we are interested in. This Hamiltonian basically just contains the kinetic energy operator, the fact that electrons are attracted by the protons in the nucleus, and that electrons repel each other. So this defines our system. We want to compute energies, so the eigenvalues of this equation, and we have to solve it for the eigenvalues and the eigenfunctions. The eigenfunctions are wave functions, and the square of these wave functions define what is the probability of finding an electron anywhere in our system. So the problem of doing that is that we have to solve this equation with respect to a constraint, namely the antisymmetry of with respect to the exchange of equal spin electrons. So any two electrons that have the same spin, if we exchange their positions, then the function psi should change sign. And a consequence of this is the Pauli exclusion, for example. So when two electrons approach each other, when two same spin electrons approach each other, then as a result of this antisymmetry constraint, the wave function must become zero, and then psi square must become zero, so they cannot be at this point. And this is really what makes solving this equation hard, right? This essentially is causing the exponential cost in, at least in theory, in trying to solve this equation, because it involves a combinatorial argument here with exchanging same spin electrons. All right, we want to turn this into a machine learning or in a deep learning problem. How can we do that? So first of all, we have to define what is the machine learning problem to solve here. And the natural choice for that is the variational approach. So the variational approach says, well, this energy that we are looking for, this eigenvalue, is the minimum of the energy defined like this over all possible functions. And we can bound that by the minimum of the energy defined like this over some functions that we consider. So these are my ansatz functions that I consider. So that's the variational approach. Basically, I parameterize the wave function somehow, and I will use a neural network for that. And I minimize this quantity over the parameters of the function. So this is my loss function. So two questions: how do we compute this loss in practice? Especially, how do we compute integrals like this? And how do we represent this function? Especially, how do we build antisymmetry into it? Okay, the natural choice for this with machine learning, for doing this with machine learning, is quantum Monte Carlo. Because if we use machine learning, especially if we use neural networks and we use stochastic gradient descent, where we will sample batches of inputs and then compute the loss function on these batches, well, then we always compute expectation values. We also compute expectation values in quantum Monte Carlo. So quantum Monte Carlo replaces this integral here by an expectation value over this quantity that is called local energy, that is just h psi divided by psi. Okay, so we basically, in order to compute the loss, we compute the expectation value over samples of electron configurations, sampled from our current belief of the electron density. And the quantity we average over is just this local energy. Okay, why is quantum Monte Carlo an accurate method? So it's actually a very accurate method, but if you're willing to pay the price. It is an accurate method because it behaves fundamentally different from normal Monte Carlo methods. Normal Monte Carlo methods, or not just every Monte Carlo method, converges asymptotically according to this equation. So the variance of an expectation value that we compute is equal to the variance of the quantity we average over divided by the number of samples. So this is slow convergence. So if that would be everything, quantum Monte Carlo would be a horrible method. But the main difference to most Monte Carlo methods that we consider is that the quantity we average over is in the solution of, so when we have found the right eigenstate psi, an eigenvalue. And therefore, it is independent of R. It's a constant. So this variance up here becomes zero in if we are close to the solution. And this is why quantum Monte Carlo actually works. This is why it actually converges to a high accuracy and doesn't keep sampling with a high variance as most other Monte Carlo methods. Okay. And of course, it's very nicely parallelizable. Which is really good for GPUs. so we can compute the instances of a mini batch in parallel. Now, the idea of using variational Monte Carlo for solving the many-body Schrödinger equation is not new. There's a very nice paper by Giuseppe Carleo and Matthias Troia. This is not 2011, this is 17, I think. Sorry for that. And what they do is they look at lattice systems, like the Heisenberg lattice, for example, and they use a restricted Boltzmann machine in order to represent their wave function. So this is a little bit of a different scope. They don't have to deal with antisymmetry. It's not a molecule, and it's not a deep network. But the basic idea of using variational Monte Carlo for this problem is the same. Now, since recently, there are essentially these two approaches to do this with fermions, electrons, and molecules, Fermi-Net and Pauli-Net. Both have appeared more or less in the same week. In September, Fermi-Net is a work by Google DeepMind. They have a relatively deep and wide neural network, compute many matrix determinants, with which they represent the wave function. And they achieve very high accuracy, but it's also very, very expensive. So for a system with 10 electrons, they will run 8 state-of-the-art GPUs for several days. Our work here is PauliNet. We haven't quite reached the same accuracy yet. Probably we will need multiple matrix determinants. At the moment, we actually use only one determinant, and we use several tricks in order to make one determinant an accurate representation. And it has a lot of physics built in, and with this physics, we can start at a very good starting point. So it's a much faster method. So, but all these things are in development, so probably in a few weeks or months, it will be already quite different. All right, let me run you through the basic ideas. The main concept is, how do we build the wave function? How do we build the ansatz function? And this is the PauliNet wave function. It has essentially four things that you need to know. First of all, it enforces antisymmetry, and it uses a so-called backflow for that. Secondly, it starts from a baseline performance, namely Hartree-Fock. So it's never worse than Hartree-Fock. Then it is trained to learn the correlation energy beyond Hartree-Fock. And it is using this form, Slater-Jastrow backflow, to do that. And fourth, it builds the right asymptotics into it, namely the cusp conditions. Okay, spins. We don't want to deal with spins, so we assign spin up and spin down electrons into two classes, and then we enforce antisymmetry among each of the classes. So we can actually work only with position coordinates within each of the classes. Secondly, we want to enforce antisymmetry. So the standard quantum mechanics approach of enforcing antisymmetry is to use matrix determinants. So the Hartree-Fock method actually is using a single matrix determinant to represent the wave function, and then the matrix determinant has this antisymmetry property built in. When we exchange rows or columns of the matrix, the sign changes of the determinant. And of course, using one determinant only is very limited, especially if we use, as it is usually done in Hartree-Fock, single particle wave function. So these are single particle functions here. And we decide which electron we want to put on which function. And by these combinations, we get different elements of the matrix. And then, of course, there are, in principle, exponentially many such matrices, because we have different ways of positioning atoms on functions. And that then, if we would take all of them, that would lead to the CI method, the configuration interaction method, which is exact but exponentially expensive. So, but basically, this construction gives us antisymmetry. That's good. Okay, now, in order to go to a better representation power and to get better than Hartree-Fock, we use something that is called backflow. Backflow follows the following idea. We take these particles, here are these positions, and they're not longer just electron positions, but we move them around. So they become sort of pseudo particles. And we move them around in a way that depends on all the other particles. Then after that, we still construct such a Slater matrix and compute its determinant. And this will still ensure antisymmetry as long as we keep equivariance with respect to permutation. So that means if flipping electrons corresponds to flipping the corresponding entries of the vector of these pseudoparticles. Yeah, if the pseudoparticles exchange in the same way as electrons exchange, this still ensures antisymmetry. But now the function that moves these electrons around to become pseudoparticles can be very complex and nonlinear and many-body. So the idea is now to replace the exponentially many determinants over simple functions with one determinant, which depends on a function. But this function is the result of a search over exponentially many functions. So it's not obvious that this is easier now, but this is something that neural networks are good at, searching a function from a large family of functions. So, okay. So we learn the spec flow. So we learn the function that modifies the Hartree-Fock orbitals, and then we put this into determinants in order to ensure antisymmetry. As I've already mentioned, the input is Hartree-Fock. So these functions here, these phi functions, are just the Hartree-Fock orbitals. So we solve them to begin with, and we put them in there. And we initialize f with just a unity function. So without training, it's just Hartree-Fock. OK. Since we use f, we can get better than Hartree-Fock. But there is a, yeah?
What is the cost of solving the Hartree-Fock? Respect to the system size, because you need it to initialize.
Yes, n cubed, I think.
N cubed.
So that's fast for a quantum mechanics method. Another function here we learn is the so-called Jastrow factor. That is a standard in variational Monte Carlo. If we have an antisymmetric function and we multiply it by the symmetric function, it stays an antisymmetric function. So we can additionally correct this function by multiplying it with a learnable symmetric function. That is this Jastrow factor. Backflow I've mentioned. So these two things here, those are neural networks. Those are deep neural networks that are trainable. This is a symmetric neural network. So basically, when we exchange elements at the input, the output needs to be unchanged. And this is an equivariant neural network. So it outputs a vector, and the elements of the vector exchange in the same way as the inputs. And it would go into too much detail to explain the architecture now, but there are essentially ways to do this. And there are many possible choices. And we picked one. Asymptotics, so it is known that any physical ground state wave function obeys certain asymptotics. So when you move an electron close to the nucleus or two electrons close to each other, the derivatives of the wave function behave in a certain way. They have a certain asymptotics. Those are the cusp conditions. And you can build that into this function here. If you make sure that this other function j has no cusps, so basically its value goes to zero at these same limits, and its derivative also goes to zero at the same limits, then you can just define a function which has these cusps, and you will have the right cusp conditions. And this is basically it. So this is PauliNet. So you input your nuclei coordinates here. You input electron coordinates. Those you will sample over as part of the Monte Carlo framework. Then this is the equivariant neural network, which essentially moves these electron positions around to become pseudoparticles. They go into your backflow. And this, together with your Hartree-Fock orbital, goes into the matrix determinants. And this is the antisymmetric part of your wave function. And then you just multiply this pointwise with a symmetric function. This part is learnable, this part is fixed. This is it. So this is the wave function you optimize over. And here are some results. So this is systems with up to 10 electrons. These are results with variational Monte Carlo, with diffusion Monte Carlo. This is another neural network-based approach, which has relatively low performance. In some cases, this is even below Hartree-Fock, those two. So that means it doesn't learn the correlation energy at all. And these are our results. They are consistently better than traditional variational Monte Carlo. And they're close to diffusion Monte Carlo. And probably they can be further improved. Here are some examples for, this is H2, this is H10. So this is the energy of H2 as a function of the distance of the atoms. This is the energy of H10 as a function of the distance of the atoms if you stretch the whole chain in the same way. So this is a strongly correlated system. And you see our results here in orange, and the exact results, or the best known exact result, let's say, are in dashed. Okay, yeah. And so that was what I wanted to tell you. So I would like to thank my group, the funders, and you for your attention.
Thanks, Brian. So we had many questions, but since we booked the room quite long, are there any more questions?
Sure. How does your last result compare to Fermi-Net?
As a Fermi-Net is much more accurate, but it also takes it gets pretty much 99 point something for all of these results, but it also takes 100 times longer. So. We're currently exploring ways to further improve these results. So I think what we'll see is, I mean, honestly, all of these methods, given a big enough network, will probably give you 100% of the correlation energy if you just train them long enough, right? If you can represent your exact wave function, then you can get 200%. So the question is how good you are at a given computational cost. So actually, we would need to report more than a number, but something like a curve, like how fast does this number decrease or increase in the correlation energy?
What's the scaling of this polynet?
So for every sample, it's n cubed, and then it's times the number of samples. So it depends how many samples you need to converge. So my guess is n to the fourth or n to the fifth.
Is there any numerical result on the scaling comparing to surgeon error?
So currently we don't have that. In Fermi-Net they do report something that looks like n squared for the number of iterations they need to converge a given system. So we'll have to see how that works out. I mean, to give you an orientation, so DFT is considered a cheap method, but of course it has also many drawbacks. That's n cubed. A cheap implementation of coupled cluster, which is considered to be a quite good method, is n to the fifth power. But it's gonna be, we can be a lot better than coupled cluster in terms of the accuracy. So I think at the range of expensive methods, I think we can be more accurate. That's the idea.
I see. Thanks.
I have a question. So about this PolyNet wave function, is there any additional qualitative extra physics, or it's just quantitative difference compared to, say, this BMC and R3?
So the physics are basically, the extra physics are these three things. Where is it? Four things, sorry. These are the additional physics. So it enforces antisymmetry, that's essential, of course. If you don't do that, you cannot use the variational approach here. And it has this baseline performance built in. So it has this Hartree Fock built in, and it has the cusp conditions built in. So these are additional physics we built in.
But it's more like, say, Fermi liquid like picture this wave function, like we coupled.
Yeah, but you can, I mean, H10, for example, is a strongly coupled system. So you can still learn to represent a strongly coupled system. So you couple here, right? This is a deep network. There's an arrow going back here. So this can be like whatever, 10 layers deep. So here you couple essentially all the electron positions with one another. So the input, these orbitals here, yes, they are uncoupled, right? There's no correlation energy in here. This is where all the coupling happens.
Thanks. Oh, okay, I missed it. What is the system for which you show results?
This?
Yeah,
H2, H10, and then here these systems.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. You're next.
So most lasers are ground states, right? Excited states.
I'm only looking at ground states here.
Okay.
One could do that with excited states, but then you have to, you have to avoid essentially falling down to the ground state when you do the variational principle. You can make a guess for your excited state energy, minimize the variance instead of minimizing the expectation value, things like that.
Like a sampling problem, like you described in the first part of
it? Yes, so one could combine these two things, of course. So the sampling problem here seems to be not as bad as in the other examples, so in the sense that the sampling seems to converge relatively quickly.
How do you know that? Oh, you mean
I don't think anybody knows that, honestly, but inside the ideas in the... the wave function has nodes where it has a certain sign, and then it changes sign at the cusps, right? Essentially, we are sampling in such a node. So it's a unimodal distribution that we are sampling. But it could still be that it converges slowly because maybe it's a very narrow and long distribution or something like this. And in this case, this would actually be quite helpful to sample IID. There's actually an interesting paper by Kaleo Troja who does something like this. For these lattice spin systems, where he constructs the wave function together with a sampling method that is autoregressive. It's in the spirit of combining these two things.
Yeah, performs much better than everything.
Yeah, but doing this for continuous positions of electrons, that's still another layer of complexity. Yeah.
So are you thinking how to make this generic? Like the model that respects all the symmetries, but also a generic model?
So that's a good question. I think there are ways how we could do this in a generic way, but if we use these exact probability methods that I described in the first part of my talk, we are forced to use invertible networks, and they are a lot less expressive than non-invertible networks. So we pay something. At this point, we want to be accurate, right? The kind of selling point of doing this is it's expensive, so at least it should be accurate. So that is not easy to overcome this.
Yeah,
okay,
I don't get the question. Because you are learning the wave function, and if it's the absolute value squared can generate new samples. Because Monte Carlo is...
No, but it's not like a direct sampling, right? Like you have to do MCMC as opposed to direct sampling in the first part of the problem.
Oh, so you want to have a quality example.
Yeah,
I see. Yeah, maybe if you use a total receive function.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to define a system that is somehow, that self-consistently samples and defines the density with respect to which it sampled, like, and this construction does something like this, right? It defines the probability density with respect to which it samples, and at the same time, it has a sampling algorithm. So if we can define such a consistent pair for the electronic Schrödinger equation, we define the value of the wave function at the same time we have something that samples from psi square, then we can in principle do that. But if we use invertible neural networks in the process, then we pay with representational power, which is bad if we want to have high accuracy. So that's the trade-off.
No more questions. Let's thank Frank for his nice talk again.
Thank you.